Welcome to the Back Asswards Podcast. We are the Back Asswards Boys. I'm Kyle. I use he, they pronouns. And joining me from our beautiful Colorado studio is Arden.
And I use he, him pronouns.
Tonight, guys, gals, and NB pals, we're doing it. We are talking conspiracy because it is JFK Part 5.
Oh, Professor Kyle. Yet.
Fuck, I don't know what the title for this episode's going to be. We'll figure it out, but it's JFK Part 5.
You're going to see it right now, audience, but we, the present Arden and Kyle, do not know what it is yet. But we are talking about conspiracy tonight, folks. This is what you all have been waiting for. We dipped our toes into it last week with our Jack Ruby episode. Just a little bit. Just a little bit of a drop of it. But now we're actually here, and now we're actually going to talk about it. And Professor Kyle's professor cap has never looked cleaner, may I say.
Never looked ready. More made out of tinfoil.
The cleanest tinfoil I've ever seen.
But before we get into it, guys, even though we are putting our tinfoil hats on today, we are still going to list our sources. And our first stop on that research train this week was our good friend Wikipedia.
Because we stan Wikipedia on this motherfucking podcast.
Go ahead and throw them a few bucks if you want to. It's their donation drive right now still. They're great. Again, I think we said it last week. The fact that Wikipedia does not have ads is absolutely mind-blowing. So throw them a couple bucks if you can, for sure.
Absolutely. It is a good... It's a good Shakespeare's Garden deed.
Ooh, no, that sounds like a Harlequin novel that I would definitely read.
Really quick sidebar, that's a poster that's on my wall, and it has all of the flowers that are mentioned in Shakespeare shows and the quotes next to them from the Shakespeare shows that relate to the flowers, by the way. It's really cool.
Send me a picture of that. That's really cool.
I will definitely send you a picture.
So I used, but I believe actually you're thinking of a philanthropic
deed. I think you're right.
Sorry, fuck. So I used their pages on the John F. Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories. I also used their pages on specifically the Zapruder film and the Babushka Lady and the single bullet theory. I also used an article from Botanica.com called Assassination of John F. Kennedy Conspiracy Theories. I used the ABC7 article JFK Unsolved, The Real Conspiracies Examines Assassinations, Who Really Shot President John F. Kennedy. I used an article from Smithsonian Magazine titled, What Does the Zapruder Film Really Tell Us? I used an article from Hollywood Elsewhere, What Was the Babushka Lady at President Kennedy's Assassination? Continuing Legends of Badge Man. And I used, What Is the Single Bullet Theory from NBC News.
I have to catch my breath.
This is officially my longest outline yet. So
no way.
Buckle in, God. Folks.
Wow. I'm so excited.
But obviously, you guys, even though we are both very excited for this episode, we are not scholars. Please, I know. Oh my God. I'm so nervous. I'm not putting out this episode because there is so much with this. There is just so much with this topic. And I simply, I'll get into it. We're not scholars. We're going to get some things wrong.
Absolutely. Like, please do not misunderstand the professor thing with Professor Kyle is a joke. It's not real.
I have no degrees. I have a high school diploma.
Me too. And
we're also not linguists. We're probably going to say some things wrong.
Please remember that we only have high school degrees.
Now, hold on to your asses, because things are about to get backwards.
Are you ready to be...
Before we get into it, I need to grab something here. I'll be right back.
Please grab it. Oh, boy. I don't know what Kyle is grabbing right now. I cannot see Kyle on my computer screen anymore, so I don't know what. Oh my actual God, Kyle is wearing an actual tinfoil hat. We've lied about it on the show before, folks. We've said that we were wearing tinfoil hats and we were lying to you. We never did that. I can assure you right now, this is happening on the Back Asswards podcast. Professor Kyle is wearing a tinfoil hat. Wow. Okay, well, it's JFK 5. I'm excited to get into the conspiracy. Kyle is wearing a tinfoil hat. take us into it. We are ready.
I feel like I need an actual cigarette in my hand right now. Okay.
I am so happy and excited. I feel like I will be smiling the rest of the episode.
Well, we have spent the last 4 weeks setting the stage and telling the story of one of the most famous assassinations of all history. And I know that Arden and I, at the very least, have come out with far more questions than answers.
Yes.
So let's get into the trenches.
Yes.
But before we get into the trenches, let's do a real quick recap, because it has been over a month, right?
It has been over a month. So let's do a little anime flashback right here.
Recap. And before we do, another little note. As I was saying, many of the topics that we're going to be talking about over the next few final weeks of this series, we will be talking about a mixture of the truth, things people who were involved think is the truth, outright lies, outright disinformation, crazed ramblings, grains of truth that were blown into mountains specifically to sell books, and everything in between. I am going to do my damnedest to cover the biggest thoughts, ideas, and theories behind November 22nd, 1963, but I am also going to try to not get too bogged down in the minutiae of every theory, and quite frankly, I will be skipping some of them, because the fact of the matter is that people dedicate their entire lives to researching and proving or disproving just one element of this story. And literally thousands of books have been written on this subject. And we're trying to cover the whole thing, and I want to be able to talk about aliens again at some point.
Right, because very much like we've said on the show before, like, we could just become a JFK podcast, but that's not what this show is, right?
No.
And so we are going, like, Kyle is constructing this series in a very specific way for a reason, for a way that fits our show, right? And so we will get to all of it, but we're not going to get to all of it. In all of it, you know what I mean?
We'll get to the most important shit, for sure.
Exactly.
Also, I'm taking this off because it's so uncomfortable.
I wish I had a timer going. I wish I would have known how long that was.
Also, I think it was doing something. Ooh,
my brain feels weird. Something. Oh, boy. I think you were connecting to the mainframe or something.
Yeah, the Pleiadians were trying to send me something.
The motherboard was finally activated.
So, like I said, let's do a quick recap of events here. On November 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated while traveling in a motorcade in an open-top limousine in Dallas, Texas. Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for the murder of Dallas policeman J.D. Tippit and arraigned for both of the murders. On November 24th, 2 days later, nightclub owner Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Immediately after the president was shot, many people suspected that the assassination was part of a larger plot, and broadcasters speculated that Dallas right-wingers were involved. Ruby's murder of Oswald compounded initial suspicions. Author Mark Lane has been described as firing the first literary shot with his article, Defense Brief for Oswald, in the National Guardian's December 19, 1963 issue. Thomas Buchanan's book, Who Killed Kennedy, was published in May of 1964 and has been credited as the first book to allege a conspiracy theory.
So just immediately, like, hot off the presses, right after this happens, people are already smelling fishiness in the water.
Yeah, conspiracy is nothing new to this. It was day one. People had questions.
Wow.
In 1964, the Warren Commission concluded that Oswald had acted alone and that no credible evidence supported the con- the contention that he was involved in a conspiracy to assassinate the president. The commission also indicated that Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara, Treasury Secretary C. Douglas Dillon, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, CIA Director John A. McCone, and Secret Service Chief James J. Rowley all individually reached the same conclusion, allegedly.
What? What?
According to John C. McAdder.
No.
I know, you just can't even hear it without calling bullshit. It's crazy.
It begins so early, my friends. I can hardly contain myself.
According to John C. McAdams, the greatest and grandest of all conspiracy theories is the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theory. Others have referred to it as the mother of all conspiracy theories. Author David Krajicek describes the Kennedy assassination enthusiasts as people belonging to conspiracy theorists on one side and debunkers on the other. But the vast amount of controversy surrounding the event has resulted in bitter disputes between those who support the conclusion of the Warren Commission and those who reject it or are critical of the official explanation, with each side leveling accusations toward the other of naivete, cynicism, and selective interpretation of evidence.
Yeah, that's typically how it goes, isn't it?
But it's interesting because they leveled the accusation, the exact same accusations at each other, both sides.
You're naive.
It's like, how can every single insurance company save me $700 a year, right?
Right.
You know?
They're all saving me $700, yeah.
All right, let's get into it. Richard Beyer wrote that many witnesses whose statements pointed to a conspiracy were either ignored or intimidated by the Warren Commission. In JFK, The Last Dissenting Witness, a 1992 biography of Jane Hill, Bill Sloan wrote that the Warren Commission Assistant Counsel, Arlen Specter, attempted to humiliate, discredit, and intimidate Hill into changing her story. What? Hill also told Sloan that she was abused by Secret Service agents, harassed by the FBI, and received anonymous death threats.
Whoa! Oh, no!
A later book by Sloan, entitled JFK, Breaking the Silence, quotes several assassination eyewitnesses as saying that the Warren Commission interviewers repeatedly cut short or stifled any comments casting doubt on the conclusion that Oswald had acted alone. Remember, J. Edgar Hoover, the same, within 24 hours of the assassination, was saying that Oswald acted alone. This was the story from day one.
Exactly. And so anyone who disputed that was getting clapped.
Yeah. In his book, Crossfire, Jim Mars gives accounts of several people who said that they were intimidated by either FBI agents or anonymous individuals that were into altering or suppressing what they knew regarding the assassination. Some of these individuals include Richard Carr, Aquila Clemens, Sandy Speaker, and A.J. Milliken. Mars also wrote that the Texas School Book Depository employee, Joe Molina, was intimidated by authorities and lost his job soon after the assassination.
What?
And that witness Ed Hoffman was warned by an FBI agent that he might get killed if he revealed what he observed in Dealey Plaza on the day of the assassination.
Bro! Oh my god! They do not want anybody talking about this, allegedly, right? And I mean, like, a lot of these are coming out in, like, books and stuff like that, but, again, very much how the United States government would like me to think, oh, well, if all of these people say the same thing at the same time, that makes it more credible, right? Then I look at these people and I'm like, huh, all of these people are saying that these intimidation tactics are coming out. Am I led to believe that that is also true?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we might get into it a little bit more in coming weeks, but some of these FBI agents and their intimidation tactics ring awfully familiar if you have done any research into the Men in Black.
Ooh, yes. And we talked about them during our Mothman series. And I'm sure that we're going to talk about them a little bit more in depth later. But they are a fascinating cryptid phenomena, alien, whatever the hell they are, Wednesday phenomena type thing. Incredible stuff. If you haven't looked into them, highly recommend it.
Wednesday phenomena, sign up for the Patreon.
For real.
But back to the topic at hand. Warren Reynolds, who claimed that he saw the shooter of police officer J.D. Tippit and chased him down the street, was shot in the head in January of 1964, just 2 days after first talking to the FBI. He survived, and Reynolds later testified to the Warren Commission that in February of 1964, somebody attempted to kidnap his 10-year-old daughter.
That is the craziest paragraph you've ever read to me on this show.
Oh, just wait, Arden.
He got shot in the head twice, survived.
Just once.
Oh, he got shot in the head once and survived.
Yes, and then someone attempted to kidnap his 10-year-old daughter after he survived the shooting.
And all he did was chase after the guy who shot the police officer in the head, which, based off of what we know, would have been Lee Oswald.
Correct. And he testified to the FBI when they showed him pictures of Oswald that he did look kind of like the guy that he chased, but he wouldn't be comfortable testifying that he was for sure the man that he chased.
That was the guy, yeah.
Because again, that goes against the timeline.
Because within 24 hours, hello, 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 they already, quote unquote, knew who did it.
But the idea that witnesses to the Kennedy assassination met mysterious or suspicious deaths because they knew that things that conspirators did not want to be revealed has been referred to by author Vincent Bilgosi as one of the very most popular and durable myths of the entire genre. Allegations of mysterious or suspicious deaths of witnesses connected with the Kennedy assassination originated with the journalist Penn Jones Jr. In 1973, similar claims about suspicious deaths of witnesses were brought to national attention by the theatrically released movie Executive Action. In 1989, Jim Mars published a list of 103 people he believed had died, quote, convenient deaths, under, end quote, under suspicious circumstances.
So this is this from the moment that this happened. It gripped people and continued to grip people and has obviously, because we are now in what this episode comes out in 2024, mm-hmm. like we are in 2024 still.
We're
talking
60 years past. Yeah.
And we don't have a clue, folks. Let's just say mm-hmm. that. But like, this is what is so fascinating about JFK.
But Arden, let me ask you something.
Please.
In the '60s, based on the research we've done on this show, who had a handbook on making people have convenient looking deaths?
You know, it's funny that you asked that question because I've been thinking about this too. And something that comes to mind is something that we talked about on this show before. It's one of our favorite characters, actually. I think what we're looking for is, I think it's a three-letter word, starts with C, ends with A, middle initial I. I think
yeah.
The CIA.
Yeah. Let's take a second to talk about the Zapruder film.
Oh God. Oh, you had me tee you up with that? What the fuck is that supposed to mean? Oh no.
We gotta build to it, Arden. We gotta build to
it. All right. All right, take me through it, Professor Kyle.
Although the Zapruder film is not the only film of the shooting, it has been described as being the most complete, giving a relatively clear view from a somewhat elevated position on the side from which the president's fatal headshot wound is visible. It is an important piece of evidence before the Warren Commission hearings and all subsequent investigations of the assassination as well. It is one of the most studied pieces of film in all history, particularly footage of the final shot, which helped spawn theories of whether Lee Harvey Oswald was indeed the lone assassin.
Because there is a lot to talk about there. Because, and as Kyle has dictated to us throughout this series, we know that JFK took two bullets, right? One to his neck, and then obviously one through his head, right? And there's a lot to talk about even in there. In every single moment of this Zapruder film, there is a lengthy conversation to be had. And I'm not joking when I say that. It is crazy how far into depth we can get into this.
Abraham Zapruder stood on a concrete pedestal along Elm Street in Dealey Plaza, holding a Model 414 PD Bell & Howell Zoom-Matic Director Series camera. He filmed from the time the presidential limousine turned onto Elm Street for a total of 26.6 seconds, exposing 486 frames of standard 8mm Kodachrome II safety film. On the morning of November 23rd, CBS lost the bidding for the footage to Lifetime magazine, to Life magazine's $150,000 offer, equivalent to $1.43 million in 2023.
Wow. Wow. My man Zapruder, dude. Made a fat stack.
CBS News correspondent Dan Rather was the first to report on the footage on national television after seeing it. The inaccuracies of his description contributed to many conspiracy theories about the assassination.
Whoa.
In his 2001 book, Tell Me a Story, CBS producer Don Hewitt said
that... Wait, I'm sorry. I really don't mean to stop you. When did Dan Rather report on this? What?
No, I don't know the specific date, but it would have been in 63.
Okay. Yeah. So the film came out in 63. It was released to the public in the same year.
Some of it.
Yes. I see.
Frames of it were released to the public.
I understand. Okay.
And that was some of the detail I kind of skimmed over is the history of the film here because we got a lot to get into. But
my bad.
But no, that's a really good question. Some of it was released to the public in frames. The very next edition of Life had, I believe, 30 frames of the Zapruder film in it.
Wow.
But it was a while before the public got the full film released to them.
Right.
In his 2001 book, Tell Me a Story, CBS producer Don Hewitt said that he told Dan Rather to go to Zapruder's home to sock him in the jaw, take the film, copy it, then return it and let the network's lawyers deal with the consequences.
Damn. He's like, go give him the business. That's how you do business.
Who gives a fuck? That is one of the most important historical films of all time. Go get it. We will handle the lawsuit.
Whatever. Exactly.
According to Hewitt, he realized his mistake after ending the telephone conversation and immediately called Rather back to countermand the offer, which apparently disappointed the reporter. Now, Dan Rathers does say that this never happened, but
you know, other people say it did,
which is the core of this entire fucking series.
That's really what it is, isn't it? Yeah. Is a bunch of people saying one thing and then a bunch of people being like, I actually think that it was something else
because this dude said so. Arguably, the most important frame of the Zapruder film would be frame 313, which captures the fatal shot to the president's head.
And I'm sorry, I just feel like I have to say this again, but like, JFK was dead.
Oh,
like when he got shot, it was over. I'm sorry.
That was it.
Like,
whether it was the first or second bullet that hit him, he was donezo.
Yeah.
He was gone. There was no coming back from that, for sure. He might have come back from the first shot through the throat, but that second headshot, absolutely not.
Nope.
After claiming to have a nightmare in which he saw a sign in Times Square with the phrase, "See the president's head explode," Zapruder insisted that frame 313 be excluded from publication. The November 29th, 1963 issue of Life published about 30 frames of the of the Zapruder film in black and white. The first view that the Zapruder film captured the shooting from beginning to end was challenged by Max Holland, author of the Kennedy assassination tapes, and professional photographer Jonathan Rush in a joint editorial piece published by the New York Times in November 2007. Holland and Rush have pointed out that Zapruder temporarily stops filming at around frame 132 when only police motorcycles were visible. I don't know if you noticed, Arden, in the footage that we just watched, the limousine kind of just appears
right
in frame, right? Like, you kind of see stuff turning the corner, and then it stops, and then the limousine appears in frame, right? Because the Zapruder stopped filming and then started again. He stopped for a few seconds.
That makes sense.
When he continued filming, frame 133 already shows the presidential motorcade in motion. And Holland and Rush suggest that the pause could have had great significance for the interpretation of the assassination.
I was just going to say, okay, and like, I'm sure that we're about to get into this, but like, what significance does that have? Like, a pause in the film, you know what I mean? Like,
right. Well, one of the sources of controversy with the Warren Report is its difficulty in satisfactorily accounting for the sequencing of the assassination, right? Yeah. When did the bullets hit him? What number of bullet was it that hit him? And what order did those wounds happen to him in, right?
Right.
A specific mystery concerns what happened to the one shot that missed and how Lee Oswald came to miss at what was assumed to be a close range, which, again, is funny that they say that here because, again, in other sources, people say it's a long range. It's one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Holland and Rush argue that the break in the Zapruder film might conceal a first shot earlier than analysts have hitherto assumed, and point out that in this case, horizontal traffic mast would have temporarily obstructed Oswald's view of his target. In the author's words, quote,
"The film, we realize, does not depict an assassination about to commence. Shows one that has already started." I mean, that's fair. Well, because, I mean, from the moment that the presidential motorcade does come in, that the car does come in, the limo, when that does come into frame, it is very quickly after that we see the first shot and then JFK grab his neck in reaction to the first shot, right? And so I feel like this is accurate, what this is saying. I guess I'm wondering if we see from the first shot to the second shot all the way to when the president's motorcade is out of frame that Zapruder can no longer document them. I wonder what the significance of the 10 to 12 or 15 or 5 seconds that we missed before means.
They're arguing there could have been another shot in there.
What I find interesting is that there's no audio, so it's kind of hard to determine if there are shots.
It's a really, really wild math game of putting together some of the... there was a police officer that had his microphone button stuck down during the assassination, and so there is audio of the assassination from the motorcade. And so people try and like combine that with the Zapruder film to find out where these things happen. Again, people go so fucking ham on this subject. It's crazy. More than any other topic I personally at least have ever researched on this show. The authenticity of the image in frame 313 is challenged by Douglas Horn, who was a senior analyst for the Assassination Records Review Board and Dino Burgani of the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center, or NPIC. Burgani was considered the world's foremost imagery intelligence analyst until his death in 2015. Horn discovered the NPIC worked on two different versions of the Zapruder film on either Saturday and Sunday nights immediately following the assassination, which had occurred that Friday. The work was done by separate teams that had been compartmentalized in order to not speak of their work, causing the teams to not know about each other, even though the personnel from the two teams normally work together on a day-to-day basis. When Horn showed his findings and evidence to Bergoni, the latter re-examined a copy of the extant Zapruder film provided by Horn. Bergoni then stated that Zapruder film in the National Archives today and available to the public, specifically frame 313, is an altered version of the film that he saw and worked with on November 23rd and 24th.
So you're telling me that the Zapruder film that you and I just watched is not the actual Zapruder film, it's a modified version of the Zapruder film?
Allegedly. See, Bergoni recalled seeing a white cloud of brain matter 3 or 4 feet above Kennedy's head, and said that this spray lasted for more than one frame of the film. Because think about it. The Zapruder film, right, when we talk about film in a camera, it's literally picture, 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 picture stacked on top of each other, right?
Uh-huh.
And the Zapruder film specifically was captured at 18 frames per second, which means it's taking 18 pictures every second.
Uh-huh.
But supposedly, we're supposed to believe that this brain matter spray only really shows up in one frame of the Zapruder film. 1/18th of 1 second.
I guess that is true, huh?
Awfully interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting point to bring up here.
Because the version of the Zapruder film available to the public shows the fatal headshot on only one frame, 313. Additionally, Bergoni was certain that the set of briefing boards available to the public in the National Archives is not the set that he and his team produced on November 23rd and 24th of 1963, meaning that the statements that the original crew that surveyed these films made was altered before they were released to the public.
Now, this is the real question here, Kyle. I think this is where the rubber truly meets the road here, is if frame 313 is altered, and if it doesn't make sense that brain matter and bone matter spray only exist for 1/18th of 1 second, then what would be the significance of modifying one frame to have a brain and blood matter spray? You know what I mean? Why would you do that?
To modify out other wounds happening to the president. Other shots coming from other directions.
I mean, it is very interesting how quickly this documentation was like seized and like paid for. And so there is something to be said there. It's like something with the film could have been meddled with for sure.
It's interesting because we're going to get to it in a little bit here. But so many other people in Dealey Plaza, because again, I believe something like 70 different people in Dealey Plaza were taking either photographs or videos of this event, right?
Right.
And the vast majority of them report that they were in that moment before they were able to leave the plaza. They were contacted by the FBI, the Secret Service, the CIA, some kind of three-letter organization to get a hold of that film.
Right.
But Abraham Zapruder was able to sell that film to Life magazine the next day.
Right.
The next day.
The very next day. Exactly. Interesting.
But another source that we've referenced in this series, the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, they deny that the Zapruder film has been altered or that any of the frames are missing from the film. And Kodak engineer Ronald Zavanda ran experiments with the film Abraham Zapruder used, the original film, and concluded that the film is authentic. But that could just be disinformation.
I suppose it could be.
Or it could be real.
Huh. It could be real.
Who knows, dude?
I mean, it's another one of those he said, she said things. You know what I mean? It's like, who do you believe? I can't believe I'm almost approaching this like aliens. Like, it's kind of like, who do you believe? Who presents the best argument? Who has the least amount of reason to lie?
That's kind of what it comes down to, honestly. And like I said, the reason we have all of this information about the Zapruder film is that in the aftermath of the assassination, the police searched for witnesses who could have captured the attack on camera or anyone who had seen where the fatal shot had come from. Their investigation revealed that hardly anyone had seen exactly what happened.
Ugh.
And if they had been using cameras, all of these cameras were, of course, pointed at the president. No one was filming the school book depository, right?
Right. And if you folks remember from part two and part three of this series, do you remember when I told you to listen to Professor Kyle when they were talking about the school book depository and all the people in Dealey Plaza and the eyewitness statements and how hard it can be to verify these types of things? That's what's happening right now. This is the result of that happening right now. And of course it makes sense that nobody saw what happened because the president with 77% approval rating is coming through unofficially starting his 1964 campaign. It's a big deal.
Of course your eyes are right there. Yeah.
Exactly.
You're not looking around.
No. And then to be broken out of that by a couple of gunshots that you don't even suspect are gunshots at the beginning, like, that's going to be hard to remember. That's a that's a crazy situation to be
in. Once that adrenaline starts pumping, your brain, the way your brain makes and stores memories is affected by adrenaline.
Absolutely.
We're going to get to that.
Oh, yeah.
So the police collected any and all footage of the assassination, hoping to find any kind of information that they could. And they found one person. Persistent in almost all photos and videos, her face concealed by a headscarf or a camera or her hands, but it was a woman. She appeared to be holding a camera and appeared to have captured the assassination on film. Immediately, the police put out a bulletin requesting information on the woman who, due to her headscarf, had been dubbed the Babushka Lady. You've heard me mention this one a few times so far.
You have mentioned this one. I'm excited.
In the decades since the assassination, the FBI still has not figured out who the Babushka Lady is for certain. They ID'd everybody. They ID'd damn near every single person in Dealey Plaza, except for her.
And they couldn't find anybody that would have been holding the same type of camera as her. Had the same
build.
We'll
get to the
her.
Type of camera here. That's really interesting that you mentioned that, Arden.
Okay, all right. I'm getting ahead of myself, Professor. I'm sorry. I don't mean to read ahead or anything like that. I'm just excited.
Over the years, though, several people have come forward claiming to be the woman, but in each circumstance, they were dismissed for lack of proof.
Yeah.
But one Babushka Lady suspect stands out among the crowd. Probably because her story is fucking bananas. Are you ready, Arden?
I'm so ready.
In 1970, a woman named Beverly Oliver was at a church revival meeting in Texas when she revealed to a conspiracy researcher named Gary Shaw that she was the Babushka Lady. She claimed she had filmed the entire assassination on a Super 8 film Yashica camera, but that before she could develop the film, two FBI agents showed up to her door and confiscated it. She admitted that she never saw their credentials, they never showed her an ID, but they claimed that they were agents. They told her that they would return the film within 10 days, but she never received any kind of confirmation, nor did she ever see the video again. She did admit that she never followed up on her own because she feared being arrested for possessing marijuana.
I am having such a hard time with this. I'm having a very difficult time wrapping my mind around this right now.
Well, as her story was picked up by local news crews and documentary filmmakers, her story was embellished. It's a fishing story. The fish gets bigger every time.
Okay.
She even claimed that she knew Jack Ruby personally and that he had personally introduced her to none other than Lee Harvey motherfucking Oswald.
Okay. Essentially alleging that Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald would have known about each other and who would have allegedly been in cahoots, perhaps.
Correct.
With one another's, right? Which I find difficult to believe. But here's the thing. It is interesting because what you're telling me is that there is a babushka lady. And that's a
He's
thing.
He's in the film. It's a thing. Yes.
But
pull up a picture for you. Yeah, let me show you.
But we have not been able to. We have not been able to positively ID. And everybody who comes forward is fucking lying. Like, this lady was full of shit, dude. Like, I could smell it.
Oh, yes.
Just the FBI agents just showing up to her house and taking the film. Like, then the FBI would know who the babushka lady was. And they exactly. would have the film. Like, then what are you talking about? All right. And why are they looking for you anymore?
Yeah, I just sent the in the text channel there. This is the babushka lady.
You know, I always imagined her wearing black for some reason.
That would be the Umbrella Man. We'll get to
him. Oh, God.
Next week.
I imagine him wearing black, too, in every single time that you brought him up. So there you go.
So as vehemently as she touted her story, those who opposed it did so with just as much righteous rage. Doubters were quick to point out that the camera that she claimed to have used, the Yashica Super 8, hadn't even been produced until 1969. And when she was confronted with this fact, she brushed it off, insisting that it was an experimental model that she got before it was even widely available and that it didn't even have a name on it at the time.
No, no, no.
My uncle works for fucking Kodak, and so I got the Super 8 early.
My papa is a general manager at Yashica. He helped them develop the Super 7.
My aunt works at Nintendo.
I got Animal Crossing 2 weeks early.
Whether Beverly Oliver's story was true or not, it immediately attracted the attention of conspiracy theorists.
Did it? Oh, I didn't see that one coming.
The assassination was obviously under scrutiny, and the presence of a mysterious woman with a camera just lent itself to the wild ideas that were already circling. Add in the fact that Oliver had claimed FBI intervention and her story was a conspiracy theorist's wet dream.
And can I just say that this is part of the problem with conspiracies? This is what's so hard about it sometimes, is that like you have someone like this that comes along and like does put a bow on it, mm-hmm. even if it's a fucking lie, you know what I mean? Even if it's a blatant lie and there's no way that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, people are so quick to be like, okay, but what if? And like, I'm going to defend this and I'm going to die on this hill.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. Like, I don't understand. But also at the same time, it's what we talk about all the time. It's like, it's important to talk about what you know and what you think you know, right?
Yeah, exactly. Some of the most common other theories were that the babushka lady was a Russian spy, or that she was a dirty government official or a Manchurian candidate. Some speculated that she was a member of the Secret Service, or even that the camera that she was holding was actually a gun.
Huh?
Maybe even a heart attack gun. Given that Oliver had seemingly come out of nowhere and it didn't fit the description of the lady in the photos, theorists immediately began to suspect that she was not what she seemed.
One of the shooters?
Mm-hmm. Her mention of the FBI agents taking her camera added fuel to the fire, and before long, theorists were using her claims to cry about government cover-ups. But for other theorists, the fact that the camera she claimed to have used hadn't been made yet lent itself to the camera gun theory, though that shortly fell off by the wayside. Today, aside from Beverly Oliver, no other leads on the babushka lady's true identity have ever quite panned out. But perhaps her story is true. And the footage really was taken by people claiming to be FBI agents, But if they were, where are they now? And more importantly, where is the footage?
Right.
Or maybe the real Babushka lady is still out there, hidden away, and holding on to her little piece of American history. Or maybe it's just getting passed down like a family heirloom, you know?
I mean, it is one of those things where, like, I'm sitting here and I'm like, well, if the FBI did steal the tape and they didn't want anyone to know, then they would never positively ID the Babushka lady, right?
Oh, of course. Exactly.
So maybe she is. I don't know, man. It's a good question.
But also, she would have been 17 at the time of the shooting. Does that look like a 17-year-old woman to you?
I'm sorry to say, folks. Like, I don't know how else to say it, but like, that does not look like a 17-year-old girl to me. That looks like
she's got that default old lady's dance for sure. Yeah.
I'm assuming she's a much older lady, but she's at least an adult. I can tell you that.
Yeah. The Warren Commission concluded that 3 shots were fired from the Texas School Book Depository in a time period ranging from approximately 4.8 to just over 7 seconds.
Huh?
Some assassination researchers, including Josiah Thompson and Anthony Summers, dispute the commission's findings.
Oh, yeah? Do they?
They point to the evidence that brings into question the number of shots fired, the origin of the shots, and Oswald's ability to accurately fire 3 shots in such a short amount of time from the rifle that he used, thus suggesting that multiple gunmen were involved.
I was about to say, there's a lot to talk about here. Like, that's pretty fast. You gotta shoot those bullets pretty fast there, Lee. Mr. Sharpshooter, middle of the road, class Lee.
Based on the consensus among the witnesses at the scene, and in particular the 3 spent cartridges found near an open window on the 6th floor of the book depository, the Warren Commission determined that the preponderance of evidence indicated that 3 shots were fired. In 1979, however, the HSCA concluded that there were 4 shots, with 1 coming from the grassy knoll.
Oh my god.
And I know we're like 2/3 of the way through this episode. We're getting to the grassy knoll next week. I'm sorry. It's next week. We're gonna get there. The Warren Commission, and then later the HSCA, concluded that one of the shots hit President Kennedy in the back of his neck, exited his throat, and it struck Governor Connally in the back, exited Governor Connally's chest, shattered his right wrist, and implanted itself in his left thigh. This conclusion became known as the single bullet theory or the magic bullet theory.
Okay. And just again, to be very clear about this, what you're telling me is that 2 government agencies said that 1 bullet inflicted all of these wounds. They concluded that.
Correct. So, well, not 2 government agencies, but 2 government investigations, right? The HSCA and the Warren
Commission. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Despite disputing on a lot of things, they both somehow agree on the magic bullet theory.
They were asking for it on this one. They were just begging for conspiracy.
Oh, just wait. We're going to... I know I said at the beginning of the episode I'm not going to get too bogged down in details. We're going to get a little bogged down in details on this one, okay?
Hell yeah.
So this theory was introduced by the Warren Commission in its investigation of the assassination to explain what happened to the bullet that struck Kennedy in the back and exited his throat. Given the lack of damage to the presidential limousine, consistent with it having been struck by a high-velocity bullet, and the fact that Texas Governor John Connally was wounded and seated on a jumper seat 1.5 feet in front and slightly to the left of the president, the commission concluded that they were likely struck by the same bullet. Generally credited with Warren Commission staffer Arlene Specter, this theory posits that a single bullet, known as Warren Commission Exhibit 399, caused all these wounds to the governor and the non-fatal wounds to the president. That totals to 7 entry and exit wounds in both men.
Which is crazy. Which is crazy, folks.
This theory says that a 3-centimeter long, copper jacketed lead core bullet from a 6.5 by 52 millimeter Mannlicher Carcino rifle fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, passed through President Kennedy's neck, into Governor Connally's chest, went through his right wrist, and embedded itself in Connally's left thigh. If this is true, this bullet traversed a back brace, 15 layers of clothing, 7 layers of skin, 15 inches of muscle tissue, and pulverized 4 inches of rib bone, and ended by shattering a radius bone. And somehow, this same fucking bullet was found on a gurney in the corridor at Parkland Memorial Hospital after the assassination. In its final conclusion, the Warren Commission found persuasive evidence from the experts that a single bullet caused President Kennedy's throat wound and all of the wounds found in Governor Connally. It acknowledged that there was a difference in opinion among the members of the commission as to this probability, but stated that the theory was not essential to its conclusions and that all members had no doubt that all shots were fired from the sixth floor window of the depository building.
I mean, it is just, I feel as though I'm living in an imaginary la-la world where impossible things can happen and impossible things are true. And I feel like they're telling me that that's real. Dude, here's the thing. It's already a stretch for it to go through my man's chest and then to go into his right wrist. But for then to go from his right wrist to his left thigh?
After it's already been through a man, dude.
That makes no sense. That makes no sense. What are you talking about? And then, dude, you and I looked at that picture of the bullet on the gurney. That bullet looks fucking immaculate.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Arden. We're going to talk about that in like 3 paragraphs here. Okay. We're going to get that in just a second.
I am just paying attention in class, and the more I pay attention, the less I know.
I said that to my partner earlier today. I was like, dude, the more I read about this fucking topic, the less I know. I came into this so confident. I got no fucking idea now, man, dude. I am so nervous for our back assward stance because
oh my God. What an adventure that will be. It's kind of how I felt during Jonestown as well.
Yeah. Most critics believe that the single bullet theory is essential to the Warren Commission's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, despite what the commission says.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it would kind of help that theory. You know what I mean?
It certainly would.
Because in case our audience has forgotten, there are pictures of 3 shell casings or whatever the hell they're called on the ground of the 6th floor of the school book depository, right? So allegedly, there were 3 bullets shot from there. And this is the only way that Lee Harvey Oswald shot 3 bullets and did all that damage. This magic bullet theory is the only way that that happens. Oh my God.
And the reason, like Arden was saying, for this is timing. As the Warren Commission found, President Kennedy was wounded sometime between frames 210 and 225 of the Zapruder film. Mm-hmm. We're going to use the Zapruder film as a time reference for the rest of this, okay? And Governor Connally was wounded in the back and chest no later than frame 240. There would not have been enough time between the wounding of the 2 men for Oswald to have fired 2 shots from his bolt-action rifle, right?
Right, because 18 frames per second, that's important.
Yes. So we're talking about, what is that? 240 to 225 is 15 frames, so that's just under a second.
Uh-huh.
Right? We're talking about between 1.5 and 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
For those wounds to happen, right? Which is also very slow for a bullet to go between 2 people.
That would be really slow. I was just thinking that.
FBI marksman who test-fired the rifle for the Warren Commission concluded that the minimum time for getting off two successive well-aimed shots on that rifle is approximately 2.5 seconds, or right between 41 and 42 Zapruder film frames.
So you need 2.25 seconds to reload and shoot that rifle efficiently. If you're fucking magnificent at perfectly. It, I assume.
That is like Yes. Perfect. That is bare minimum, right?
Yeah, 15 frames is not enough, my friends. That is not... that the math does not compute. But I guess this would also lend credence to what you were saying earlier, Kyle, about there being potential skips in the Zapruder film. Can we really rely on it as a measurement of time? That's something I just considered as I was saying it out loud.
I hadn't considered it either. That is a very interesting thought.
Huh. Interesting.
Given the earliest possible frame at which Kennedy could have been struck, frame 205, and the minimum of 42 frames or 2.3 seconds required between shots, there is insufficient time for separate bullets to be fired from this rifle. Several assistant counsels, upon viewing the film for the first time, concluded that there simply had to be two assassins.
Okay. Oh, God. There's something that I want to say, but I'm saving it for the right time to talk about it.
Please, like, type it out. Don't forget. I want to know.
Yeah.
Don't forget. Put a bullet in it.
Yeah. Hey, that was a good one, Kyle. Hey, that was a good one.
Hey, they gave him a snap while you're doing that. How you feeling?
I feel very okay. I definitely, based off what I've seen from the Zapruder film, I definitely think that it is fair for the frames that we're talking about, that they are sequential frames. I think that it's fair to say that this timeline that you're going through right now with the Zapruder film is an accurate depiction of time, because that part of the film does not seem to be uninterrupted, because I know the stop that they're talking about in the film, and there's nothing that looks like that between these frames, right? Exactly. The whole sequence.
That stop in the film is in like the 130s, right?
Right. And what I'm saying is that I know what that stop looks like on that camera, and that sort of camera distortion did not happen at any point during these frames that we're talking about. So exactly. I think it's fair to talk about this like it is the accurate time frame of it, right?
Right.
And agreed. So that's what I think about the Zapruder film. I am totally buying into more assassins now. And it's because of this piece that I want to talk about right here. It's because of this that I think that there's got to be at least four. There's got to be at least four, Kyle. Yeah. There's got to be. There has all right. to be.
We're almost done with the magic bullet, and then let's talk about that, okay?
Okay, did you see what I typed in there?
Oh, I didn't yet. Was it in the... Okay, boom. Yes. Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay, perfect, perfect, perfect.
The commission, however, did not conclude that the single bullet theory had been proven, as three members of the body thought that the theory was improbable. In the end, the commission changed the word compelling to persuasive and stated, quote,
although it is not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connally, there is very persuasive evidence to indicate that the same bullet which pierced the president's throat also caused Governor Connally's wounds. They're really sticking to it.
Mm-hmm.
They are really gung-ho on this one.
So let's end the episode today by going over just how magic this bullet really was and going over its supposed flight path step by step.
Oh, this is what I was born to do. This is my Manchurian candidate objective. You know what I mean? This is what was created to do right here, is listen to Professor Kyle dictate the flight path of the magic bullet.
After being fired, the bullet ballistically arced very slightly while traveling 189 feet in a downward net angle of 19 degrees after an initial supersonic exit muscle velocity between 1,850 to 2,000 feet per second. It then entered President Kennedy's rear suit coat at about 1,700 feet per second. After impacting, it then entered President Kennedy 2 inches to the right of his spine, with this angle suggesting that the shooting position was above and to the rear of Kennedy. It damaged the president's first thoracic vertebra. There is debate whether the bullet itself struck the vertebra and caused this damage, or whether a pressure cavity wave that was created by the bullet's passage was responsible, but it damaged his vertebra.
Okay.
It passed through his neck. Warren Exhibit CE386 reported contusions or bruises on the apex of his right lung in the region where it raises above the clavicle, which is consistent with a bullet passing through the neck immediately over the top of the right lung, but without penetrating the lung beneath.
Wow.
So we're talking about right at the bottom of the neck, right? Like right where the neck meets the chest, it came out.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
So it came through at a pretty steep angle to go right right behind his spine and then out through his neck, right?
Yeah, downward angle from what it sounds like too.
Almost like it came from the sixth floor of a building.
Yeah, almost like it could have come from the sixth floor of a building. You're exactly right.
After passing through President Kennedy's neck and exiting through his throat at the center line below the president's Adam's apple, and it's interesting to note that within 3 hours of the assassination, this frontal neck wound was described as being an entrance wound.
Huh?
The ER doctor, Dr. Perry, stated that the neck frontal wound appeared to be an entrance wound 3 separate times during his press conference. However, medical researchers have found that ER doctors do frequently make mistakes with regard to exit and entrance wounds, and that both Dr. Perry and Dr. Carrico, the other attending ER doctor, later testified at the Warren hearings that with a full jacketed bullet, the wound in the front of the throat could have been either an entrance or exit wound. The Parkland ER doctors also never examined the wound in the back and could make no comparisons with it. The bullet passed through both sides of his shirt collar front in alignment with the collar buttoned, in line with the throat wound, and with the threads in both bullet slits forced outward that showed that this was probably an exit wound. So the literal threads around this bullet hole were pushed outwards, showing, like, pushed to the front of Kennedy, showing that this was probably where the bullet exited, right?
Right.
It nicked President Kennedy's tie knot on its upper left side, and upon clearing the tie knot, the bullet had slowed to about 1,500 feet per second and had started to tumble. It then traveled 25.5 inches between President Kennedy and Governor Connally.
Wow. 25 and a half inches has never felt like such a long measurement to me before.
Right?
Oh, that is such a fucking long distance, I feel like, for this circumstance.
It then impacted and entered Governor Connally's back, just below and behind his right armpit, creating an 8 millimeter by 15 millimeter elliptical wound, indicating that the bullet was fired from an acute angle to the entrance wound point, or that the bullet was tumbling, having hit something earlier on its way, presumably President Kennedy.
Right.
According to President Connally, the impact of the bullet was very forceful, which does track if it was a tumbling bullet, right? Because if a bullet hits you sideways, it's going to do a hell of a lot more damage and feel a hell of a lot more forceful than if a bullet hits you head on.
Right. And 1,500 feet per second is nothing to bat your eyes at, folks.
No, that's still fast. Supersonic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the physics of the impact, this means that the bullet imparted part of the momentum to Connally's body, and therefore the bullet's momentum changed either in speed or direction or both upon entering his body.
Woof.
It completely destroyed about 5 inches of Connolly's fifth right rib bone as it smashed through his chest interior at a documented 10-degree downward angle. So it lost about 9 degrees of angle in flight going through Kennedy and into Connolly.
Damn.
It exited slightly below his right nipple, creating a 50-millimeter sucking air blowout chest wound.
Right. Okay. All right. This is making sense so far. I'm tracking this.
It then passed through Connolly's shirt and suit coat front, exiting roughly central on the coat's right side, just under the lowest point of his right lapel. At this point, the bullet had slowed to about 900 feet per second, becoming subsonic, and entering through Connolly's right upper wrist, but missing his suit coat sleeve. It penetrated the doubled French cuff shirt sleeve at the wrist area, but did not penetrate the cuff upon exit. Uh-huh. At this point, it had broken his right radius wrist bone at its widest point, which deposited metal fragments that remained inside of him the rest of his life.
No. No.
It exited the palm on the inside of Connolly's wrist, slowing to 400 feet per second, and then it entered the front side of his left thigh, creating a documented 10-millimeter, nearly round entry wound. Then it finally buried itself shallowly in Connolly's left thigh muscles. And then somehow was found fallen out at Parkland Hospital, supposedly when Connolly was undressed, landed on Connolly's gurney, and was discovered by hospital engineer Daryl C. Tomlinson after it rolled into view after Connolly's gurney was bumped.
No. No, I'm sorry. No. I've seen the bullet. I've seen the bullet. The bullet looks pristine. It looks immaculate, my friends. That is the craziest part of this.
Why don't you look at that mess? Why don't you look at that? The path that this bullet would have had to have taken.
Dude. My friend. No. Look at this. Look at that bullshit. Oh my God, you're right. Because this was one of the questions I was going to ask. Is like, if I'm not mistaken, Connolly was driving, correct?
He was, he was in a passenger? Jump seat. Yeah, he was a passenger.
If he was the driver, it would have made more sense, right? Because the driver would have been to the left of JFK.
A little bit. And some people, I will say, have tried to argue that this is closer to the positioning that they were in, which might help it make slightly more sense. But it also isn't accurate to how they were sitting in the vehicle. So
let me see if I can make sense of this in the ZipRecruiter film. Oh, you want to know what is interesting, though? Is that this man right here, this Connolly guy, I'm looking at him in the ZipRecruiter film. When the first shot goes off, he turns the fuck around.
Yeah. What's your point?
I'm just saying. Okay, but wait. Wait. You're telling me. Hold on. You're telling me that the bullet that went through JFK's neck allegedly went through outward front ways through his neck.
Yeah, this is the first Connolly, shot we're talking about, right?
Hit Connolly, right? So then if my man is turning around, how is he not like, oh, my fifth fucking rib, dude? Like, what do you mean? It was supposed to happen that fast. He would have already been hit. Why is he turning around? Why is he talking? No, 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 you will die. This is bullshit, dude. This is not real. I live in a fucking fantasy world, dude. I live in La La Land, dude. Nothing is real.
Oh my God.
What is that? What is that? And look at this. The first picture you sent me, look at that. What is that? No.
And despite all of this, all seven members of the Warren Commission signed off on the statement, quote, yeah, I'm going to make you say it, motherfucker.
Do it. There was no question in the mind of any member of the commission that all the shots which caused the president's and Governor Connally's wounds were fired from the sixth floor window of the Texas School Book Depository.
Arden is literally having a mental break right now.
So frustrated. How? How can you say that? How can you say that? I couldn't say it with a straight face. I'm so sorry. I hope you all know I'm not leading you down a pipeline. I'm just saying this doesn't make any sense. And
no.
I'm a dumbass. I'm not smart.
It's just absolutely ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. That one bullet caused seven wounds in 0.75 seconds of the Zapruder film, where my man turns around and looks at the president.
And
are
that,
you joking?
My little researchers, is the magic bullet theory, the babushka lady, and the Zapruder film. We'll be coming back next week with even more bullshit, dude. Holy fuck.
Oh my god, Kyle. My friend, can I please just say, first and foremost, excellent work on this outline, my friend. You have done such a great job laying this down, flopping it out, putting it on the table, just showing how many lies will be told throughout the course of this series. Wow. I mean, what a way to get into the conspiracy of this. I mean,
we got a long ways to go.
We do have a long ways to go. Believe
there's
me.
There's so much more to talk about.
Holy we've God. Now talked about what? The mafia, the magic bullet theory, and the babushka lady at this
yes.
point, right?
Yeah.
And so we've hit three of the big ones so far.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, you know, doing your JFK back asswards bingo, which maybe we should get that going, but if you are doing that, you can put those three on your bingo cards right now because
do it
because they're coming. I am in complete shock right now.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, we pretty much like we hit the magic bullet theory pretty hard tonight, folks. And
because I know Arden was very interested in that one, so I did spend a little bit of extra time on that one.
And I do appreciate that, Kyle. I also just feel like it's such an important component to the story because, like I said earlier when I was losing my mind, the only way that Lee Oswald, being the only assassin, the only shooter in this scenario, the only way that that works is if the magic bullet theory is correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's
and do you think the magic bullet theory is correct, Arden?
Absolutely not. Are you joking me? Are you joking? No, it is such a goddamn lie. I cannot even express to you. And this is what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, let's get into it. Let's get into it. Here, wait.
You want to know what's crazy about this? Yes, the tinfoil hat has come back on.
What's crazy about this, Arden?
You want to know what's crazy about this? Me and my dad were talking about this the other day. Me
yes,
and my father were talking about this the other day. And he brought up something to me that blew my goddamn mind. I couldn't believe that I hadn't thought about it. It's what I typed in the Discord.
Right.
If JFK got shot, which he did, but if he got shot in the back of the neck, why? Then tell me why, when he reaches to, like, in reaction to the bullet entering the back of his neck, why does he reach for the front of his neck? I would imagine, now, I've never been shot, okay? But I would imagine that if I got punched in the back of the head, that I would reach for the back of my head. right?
Right.
And
right.
if a bullet entered me through the back of my neck, I would assume that I would grab the back of my neck because that's the entrance wound, right? But if you watch that Zapruder film, which trigger warning, by the way, if you go watch it, it's very easy to find, but trigger warning. If you watch that, he grabs the front of his neck when that shot allegedly happens, right?
Right.
What does that fucking mean, dude? Is it just one of those fight or flight responses? Because, I mean, also to be fair to JFK, my man just got shot. He's got a lot going on in that moment. So I can't necessarily blame JFK for reacting the way that he did. But it is just an interesting thought that my dad put into my head. And honestly, I'm wondering your thoughts about it, Professor Kyle, because if that's the case, there's at least four shots.
Yeah.
Because there are three casings on the floor of the Texas School Book Depository.
So there has to be three shots from there.
Yes. And I don't know about you, and I don't know what other theorists say, but there being three bullet casings on the floor does tell me that three bullets were shot. I feel like I could safely assume that.
Yeah, it would be weird to plant extra bullet casings. That doesn't right. make any sense. Yeah.
Right. So there would have to be at least... But you want to know what's interesting is that people are talking about if there's BOFA, threefa, or fourfa shots. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's a hard distinguishing factor to make.
Mm-hmm.
But I am wondering your thoughts on JFK grabbing the front of his neck.
I hadn't ever really had that thought before. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, I'm already with you in the there's more shooters. JFK's got shooters, you know. Plural.
With the tinfoil hat and everything.
I don't know. I think you could chalk it up to like a fight or flight, adrenaline's pumping, you're not necessarily making the most like rational decisions thing.
Right.
Or he got shot in the front of the throat because the fucking ER doctor literally said it could have been an exit or entry wound and they couldn't tell the difference.
I thought that it was interesting that you brought that up. And then you also followed it up with like, sometimes ER doctors will get that wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess it's not unfair to say that this ER doctor could be wrong. You know what I mean?
It's a possibility.
It is interesting that upon first glance, a trained doctor was like, that's the entrance wound. That is interesting. It would be disingenuous to say that ER doctors don't sometimes get it wrong. I think it's fair to say that. But then it's also fair to say that at first glance, this ER doctor said it was an entrance wound. I think that's fair.
They also get it right sometimes.
I think that's fair. You know what I mean? But what is interesting, and oh, damn it. We can't even talk about it yet because we haven't even gotten to the autopsy.
No, we're going to get to the autopsy next week.
Okay.
Next week, I think. We'll see.
So we'll
see. I'm not going to make any problems. So we'll save it. Just like we've been saving our back-assward stance this whole series, and I know it's killing me and Arden, but, you know, we want to have all of the evidence presented before we make any conclusions, right?
There is also one other thing that I'd like to talk about, at least that I would like to talk about before we let the audience go for tonight. It's something that you did bring up very briefly in this outline, which was the vantage point that Lee Oswald would have had in this circumstance. And again, if you remember from our Lee Oswald episode, he was ranked as a sharpshooter, which is tier number 2 out of 3, which means he was average. Mid to low. Yes, he did
get downgraded to the first level before he left the Marines.
That is correct. And so this guy is at a vantage point. He's at an angle, right? And the bullet track from JFK, you know, it does seem to indicate that if their story is correct, that the bullet tracks from right to left, which is the angle that Lee Oswald would have been at. I followed up until that point, right? But then it makes a very sharp curve, whatever, right? We'll talk about that. But something else that's also important to note about Lee Oswald's vantage point from the sixth floor of the school book depository is that there were obstacles in his way.
Several. There were trees. There was a road sign. There was a light post.
things blocking his view, which I don't know about you, but even if I was a trained marksman, sharpshooter, even, this would present a challenge. And I think that Lee Oswald was faced with this challenge. And I think that that's hard to pull off when you're under this much stress. You just lied to everyone about your curtain rods. You know what I mean? The last thing you need is for that paper bag to rip and then your gun falls out of it. God, you know what I mean? Can you imagine if that's how this day went? Oh my God. The CIA would have killed him one day later, not 2 days. They wouldn't have given him 2 days.
No.
But in terms of this magic bullet theory that we've been discussing, and I know that you're the professor, and I know that you don't give the game away because you're so good at it, but I am wondering if you have any thoughts that you'd like to leave us with before we dismiss class, Professor.
Oh, it doesn't affect the story at all that I'm telling for me to tell you that the magic bullet theory is absolute horseshit. It just is.
It just doesn't make any sense.
No, it really doesn't. And yeah, that's part of why I spent so much time talking about it, because fuck them, dude. That theory's bullshit. Sorry. And that's the whole thing that the Warren Commission's findings kind of hinge on. And so if that's bullshit, that whole investigation is bullshit.
And you want to know what else that implies? That Lee Oswald didn't do it by himself.
Exactly. And with that, we're going to pick it up next week.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to the podcast, everybody.
Thank you so very much. It means so much that you folks could be doing anything with your time, and you're listening to the Backasswards Boys on part 5 of JFK. Oh my God. We are really trudging along through it. And
You know.
The Backasswards podcast is your favorite podcast, and they are the most grateful podcast to you, specifically, the listener.
Absolutely. You can subscribe and review if you are enjoying the show, and if you think someone else will enjoy the show, please share it with them. You can listen to our previous episodes for more. I would recommend our episode on Walt Disney's frozen head.
Ooh, speaking of things being frozen, there's also a movie called Frozen, and that's part of the conspiracy that you can listen to in that episode. It was fun. That was a fun episode. I liked researching it.
Arden did a great time. A great job. And I
highly recommend.
You can follow me and Arden on Twitter. I am at @BackassWordKyle. Arden is at @Arden_Smith. And you can follow the podcast on all of your favorite social medias. On Twitter, @BackassWordsPod. Instagram, @BackassWordsPod. TikTok, @BackassPod. On Facebook, search the Backasswords Podcast. And if you want even more, go ahead and subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/BackassPod. If you sign up, you get a shout out on the main show. And if you sign up at our $5 tier, you also get a bonus episode every single week. It's a great time. We have loads of fun.
The Wednesday Phenomena. Come join us. It's a good time.
I'm Kyle.
I'm Arden.
And we'll see you next week. Unless some old lady is standing outside of your house and filming you, and it turns out that the thing she's filming you with actually is not a camera, and it's a heart attack gun, and you have a heart attack, and you fucking die.
And when that lady points that heart attack gun at you, just remember that one of the only surefire ways to defend yourself from a heart attack gun is your tinfoil hat, so that you can stay safe, my friend.
And when you put on your tinfoil hat, make sure that you are doing it while you're looking out your front window at your neighbor, Miss Jenkins, who lives across the street, who is just taking her dog out to go to the bathroom. That's all she's doing. But make sure you look her dead in the eyes and you say, I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. I know about MKUltra. You can't get me. You can't get me. So that you can stay weird.
Oh my God, the danger is real, my friends. If someone in a tinfoil hat starts yelling at you, tell them to listen to the podcast. It's not real. They're not thinking properly. Stay safe.
We'll see you guys next time.